Good afternoon. So, last time we finished up talking about cycle times. Apparently a lot of people decided to start to break early. And we discussed that that's made by the slowest path. And this principle holds true in general, that if we look at the path from a state output, something which changes when we have a rising edge of the clock, like a register, gets a new value at that rising edge of the clock, to some state input, like a register input, it reads it at the rising edge of the clock, or the register file write input, it takes care of those at the rising edge of the clock. We need to have enough time for the value to get from those outputs to those inputs. And when we're reasoning about what to set the cycle time to, what we do is we just say, what are the paths from state output to state input? So, for example, going from the PC back to the PC, we go through that adder, we need enough time for that to work. We also have to worry about going through the instruction memory, then through whatever logic computes the instruction length, and through that adder, and so on. And we have to worry about going through the register file and through the ALU and into the instruction memory, sorry, the register file again to write a value, so on. And we can just measure how long each of these takes. Presumably, if we're building a processor, we'll be told by the person who gave us our register file, hey, my register file is this fast. And we can also look up our instruction memory is this fast, and so on. Add those together and learn how long each of these paths are. And after we enumerate all those paths, we know that whichever one has the most time, that's what we're going to set our cycle time to. And this is how we come about that that this instruction length computation ends up not mattering. Because, yes, it takes time, but all that time is the same time we're actually going through the register file, and in this case, with these measurements, the register file plus the ALU plus the data memory take longer, so it doesn't matter how long our instruction length and instruction addition computation takes, as long as it's not longer than that. And we can do this sort of analysis for even our simple processor. So when we're thinking about the sequential case, we say, okay, we can go through that add two, we can go through the instruction memory to where the register file needs to know what register number to write. We need to have that set up by the end of the clock cycle. We also need to read a register, add it, and have that new value to write set up by the end of the clock cycle. So we enumerate all these paths, and we take the longest, and that's our cycle time with this sequential single cycle processor. And we're going to do the exact same analysis for our pipeline processor, but now our paths are going to still go from state element to state element, but we have these extra things, these pipeline registers, and they're just says state inputs and outputs. So we need to worry about how long it takes to go from PC to these pipeline registers, from PC to PC, from this pipeline register to that one, and so on. We're just taking the maximum of all those. So it's really the same computation. And conceptually, you think of this as being, what's the time for the longest stage? So whenever one of these is longest, that's going to correspond to a pipeline stage. We're going to have some probably pipeline registers it starts at, and some either pipeline registers or something that's part of a stage, like writing the registers is part of the write-back stage that it ends at. And we'll consider that path to be part of a stage, and the slowest one determines our speed. And so this sort of computation is how we set our cycle time. So something notable here that doesn't come out so much in this picture is that this is going to include our register delay. So what we're saying is that we're going to have a rising edge of the clock and so on. And if we consider, say, this path from here to here, we're saying that at the beginning of this, we're going to need a little bit of time for the PC register's value to change, that first half of the register delay. And at the end of this, we're going to need a little bit of time for this RA register to read its value. Remember, the register delay had those two components. and they're going to be included in our time. So this measurement of how long the path is needs to include those register delays. And one way we can think about that is that we have the half after the beginning of the cycle and the half before from one register to the other. And we just add those together and that's included. Or you can say that we're actually going to measure, we're not going to measure this time, but we're going to measure instead. We're going to measure, say, the time that for the PC register to act up until when things need to be ready for that next register. And those two measurements of time are the same, so it doesn't matter which register delay we think we're measuring, as long as we include the register delay when we're counting how long the paths are. So if we tell you that the instruction memory takes 200 picoseconds and the register delay is 10 picoseconds, you'll say that the time is 210. And, and we're accounting for the registers on both ends when we make that assessment. Any questions about how we do these computations? How you would go if I told you, here's a circuit, here's how long each of the components take. We got our register file and they told us it takes this long. How long is our cycle time? Any questions on how you would go through that process? Okay. So let's move on to continuing to talk about our add processor. So we went through, this is how it worked out. And we added these registers, and we're going to need to talk about how that works out when we actually write HCL code. And our book has a particular, kind of peculiar naming convention. And we're going to want to actually understand that. And so what our book does is that we're going to have these registers in HCL. The way we use HCL, we're going to declare this as register FD. And you may vaguely remember from when I went over HCL and I talked about register banks, that our register banks are named with two letters, one which represents the input signals and one which represents the output signals. The input signals always have lowercase and the outputs always have uppercase. So that means that if this register here is RA, then its input signal is called little f underscore RA, and its output signal is called big D underscore RA. And the convention that our textbook follows is that we have lowercase and the letter of the stage is the outputs from that stage, and uppercase and the letter of the stage is the inputs to that stage. So within a stage, you're generally going to be dealing with only things that start with the letter of that stage. So everything in fetch is f some underscore something, either upper or lowercase. Everything in decode is d underscore something, either upper or lowercase, and so on. Except, of course, for the built-in components like the register file, like reg source A is still going to be called reg source A. It's not going to be called d reg source A. And so this applies in general. So we'll just name our registers by convention based on the two stages they're between. So between decode and execute will be DE. And in this case, between execute and write back will be EW. Note that when we have our full processor, we'll have a memory stage in between, so there won't be any EW. And generally, it's lowercase f fetches values there, uppercase d, that's where those values go, and so on. So this is the convention our textbook follows, and obviously our HCL language is designed to support that really well, but it's just a convention, and you could do something else, and as long as you're consistent, it will work. You probably want to follow this convention, because then you can read the textbook and it will tell you what to do more directly. Otherwise, you kind of have to translate, but you have the flexibility to name them whatever you want. So with this, what we're going to do, we write our add queue in HCL, is we're gonna have to declare these registers. So we have those registers that I drew on the picture, and they each need a declaration. They aren't built in, just like our PC wasn't built in, so we need to declare them. So I'm naming them based on the stages they're between. So FD for fetch to decode, and we have DE for decode to execute, and I'm not showing the execute to write back here. And when we declare registers in HCL, we need to specify the size of the register. So we have register numbers, those are 4 bits, so we have 4-bit registers, and we need to specify a default value. And this default value actually matters. And a way you can think about it is that we're gonna have, if we go back to this picture here, that I have a blank space here, but the register has a value. There's a wire coming out of it, has a signal on it, which has a value, and we need to make that not do anything bad. So we're gonna make it do conceptually enough. And to make that happen, I chose to make this value be regnon, which is, remember, is also the same as 15. And that means that when the values in these registers propagate down here, we'll have red regnon here. So we'll get 0, 0, and regnon. And that will propagate down to write back in the next cycle. So just like normal instructions go out, and we have this sort of phantom instruction because our register started with a value, we want to make sure that's a no-op instruction. And by setting register B to regnon, that's the register non is what's going to end up a couple cycles later in write back, so we won't write anything. So if you set it to 0, then will we be writing RIX, and that could turn out badly. And the general rule is we're always going to have our default values be something which corresponds to a no-op. And this is even in the case like here, where we technically, you know, we don't really implement a no-op instruction, we still need that to deal with that startup time, to make sure we don't actually write registers that there was no instruction to write. And other than that, as I hinted, we rewrite the code for fetch. We deal with things prefixed with F, and in this case, I10 bytes. I10 bytes is conceptually part of the fetch stage because when we drew our boxes about where stages are, we included the instruction memory in there. Similarly, when we write our decode, we're dealing with signals prefixed with D. Both our inputs and outputs work that way. So big D underscore RB is the value we got from the fetch stage in the previous cycle. And we deal with signals prefixed with red because the register file, part of it is conceptually in the decode stage. When we drew that box, we included the register file in it, and that's why we're allowed to use those signals. And so we get this transformation where most of our intermediate signals change to these ones which go to pipeline registers, and other than that, the code is basically the same. So any questions on what this transformation looks like? Okay, maybe not. And of course, we also need all the pipeline registers, so here are what they are. And this is for add, and you could have figured that out because I drew the picture with all the components we needed for add, and like I had the lines crossing and I found what those registers were. We'll talk about a different strategy for figuring this out that's perhaps more scalable to the entire YAD6 instruction set. So if you remember when we were talking about all of YAD6, we ended up with something like this, and there's a lot of things going on in this picture, and you might be missing things. And we also are missing like control signals. So this is not even a complete picture. Like we have muxes, we don't have the wires which control those muxes, and that's gonna be affected by pipelining. So first, let's try to figure out what the pipeline registers are from this. So the first thing we need to do is add the stages. So I've just highlighted where our stages are, and this is just by what our textbook chose to do. And ideally what we'd like to do, just like we do with add, is we just draw lines between the stages, and everything which crosses those lines has a pipeline register. So if we try to do that, if I just say everything that crosses those lines I just drew, I'm going to put in a register, I'm going to have a bit of a problem. So what's the issue that I need to deal with first? It's very similar to something we have with happen with add. There's one case where something is a bit wrong there. Yes.
Register source A is going directly into memory. Yes.
So your complaint is that here we're going to there, and you don't like that. So that's going to be fine as long as I make sure I add two sets of registers because I have two lines. But I do need to add two. I can't just add one, because I need to have two values of in this case, ballet in flight, right? One for two different instructions that might end up going to memory. So you're ready to do something special, but adding registers, everything that crosses that line should be enough for that case. But there's another case where we need to do something similar, but just adding registers where I drew lines isn't quite enough. Yeah.
For the write back stage?
Yes. So what about the write back stage?
It's going to be the destinations are going to be from the most recently parsed instruction, and so it'll get lost by the time the actual data comes around.
Yeah. So our problem here is that we have these destination signals. If I just add a register there, if I have a program with instruction 1, then 2, then 3, then 4, well, then instruction 1 is in write back, instruction 2 is in memory, instruction 3 is in execute, instruction 4 is in decode, and it's instruction 4 that's being output by this register bank. So we'll have instruction 4's register numbers to write to, but instruction 1's register values to write. And I had this problem with add, and my solution was to redraw the wires. And I note that this problem is really subtle if you're debugging. So if you make this mistake in your process, in your like HCL processor, and look at the output, really weird things will happen. Because maybe it happens that the instruction 3 ahead has the same register number some of the time, and not always. But our solution as far as this picture is that I'm going to redraw my signals so they always advance from one stage to the next. So everything goes from fetch to decode to execute to memory to write back. I never skip a step. Because my problem before is I was going directly from fetch to write back, even though that's not where our instruction conceptually goes. So now if I draw the lines, I have there, here, 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 and I don't see any cases where I'm skipping stages. In each case, I go from one stage to the next without skipping. And so what we'll do to finish this off is we'll just add a whole bunch of pipeline registers. I'm just going to draw one big register. This really will be divided up into registers for each of the wires, but just to keep the drawing less cluttered, I'm just going to draw a big register that we assume has all the values and all those wires that are going across it. So this is sort of gives you one picture of what values are we putting in pipeline registers, but it's not actually a complete picture. And the big thing we're missing is control logic. So we have these muxes here, and I'm not even showing how we set those muxes to do what they need to do. There's something else I should note about what I did here, because it will come up later, is when I rearranged my wires to go from one stage to the next, I chose to put the decision of what register number to write to in the decode stage. This is the decision our book does, and we didn't have to do that. We could have put it in the write back stage. We could have left it there and just sent all the input signals all the way through. We'll see probably after break why this is a really, really useful decision to do it this way, and we will be doing that. But you know, that's just a decision our textbook made, which isn't the only way to do things. So generally, when we're writing our pipeline code, we're going to follow this pattern where we read the prior stage's output and write the prior stage's input, next stage's input, with only the exception of when we have deliberate sharing between instructions. And we saw this with how we had to reorganize our wires to make sure we are always going from one stage to the next. And the way this will manifest in HCL is that when you're writing the code for a stage, you better not be using wires from some other random part unless it's because you're sharing between instructions. Like for example, if we're doing a conditional jump, well, you want a different instruction to figure out the result of that condition because it has to fetch the PC correctly. So that might be okay. So with that in mind, let's talk about control logic. So one of the things you recently had to implement was memory read and write. And basically what you did is you got the I code and you determine whether it was a read or a write. So the code for this might look like you have want to set mem write bit. And you probably did this with something like if I code in MR or RM move Q, and maybe some other options than one, otherwise zero. Probably had code like this, where I code came from the instruction memory, so I code was some part of I10 bytes. Any questions about sort of that HCL layout? Okay. So, can I just, you know, this is the code I wrote for my single cycle processor. When I'm going to make it into a pipeline processor, can I just use that? Well, presumably I'm asking some no. So what's going to go wrong if I just try to do that? I just try to leave the code as is.
The I code's
going to be from the wrong instruction. How's that going to manifest when I'm debugging my HCL program? Okay, so one thing that will happen is that when we're supposed to be writing to memory, we probably won't be, because there'll be another instruction who's in the fetch stage, whose PC we're passing, and that will tell us not to set the write bit to one, most of the time, but not always. Another thing that will happen is that when we read our memory writing instruction, whatever happened 3 cycles before it, whatever was fetched 3 cycles before it, will be in the memory stage. And that instruction is going to write memory even though it's not supposed to. Whatever values are in front of the memory, whatever the result of the mux you have for the mem value and mem adder, that's going to be used, even if it's like an add. Yeah, another way of putting it is that, so we have our fetch, decode, execute, memory, write back. So if we have instruction 1 in memory, 3, 4, it's instruction 4 is going to determine whether or not we write to memory. So you'll do, and that's what our mixup is going to be. So the solution to this is that we're going to look at this advice and say, we're going to only read the prior stage's output. And we need to know the I code, but we don't want to know the I code of instruction 4. We want to know the I code of instruction 1. And the only way we're going to be able to find that out is we're going to have gotten it from execute in the previous cycle. And execute in the previous cycle, we'll have gotten it from decode in the cycle before that, and so on. So to get it from execute in the previous cycle, we're going to have our execute to memory register bank. It's going to contain a register with the I-code. So our previous cycle, the previous stage, when we was executing this instruction and execute, set that. And ultimately, that was set by the instruction memory several cycles before, back when this instruction was in fetch. And we're going to need to do this a lot, because pretty much all those muxes I showed you need the I-code. When you've written your HCL code, you've written a whole lot of muxes where you do I-code is something, then do something. So where we have code like this, what we started out with, we're going to end up with code like this. We're going to have our register bank, and part of our register bank is going to be this I-code signal to know, which originally comes from the instruction memory. And just like before, we need a default, and your default should be no op because, well, you want those phantom instructions when we start up our processor not to do anything. And instead of setting a global I-code signal, we're going to set one for a particular stage. So in the case of our fetch stage, we're going to set the output I-code to be what we read from the instruction memory. That's going to be read in the decode stage and used to be sent to the next stage, and so on. Execute will send it, will receive its I-code from decode and send it to memory. And finally, in memory, we won't look at just this global I-code signal. We'll look at the one that belongs to us that came from execute from the previous cycle. Yes?
If we send the default I-code to no op, then when it propagates to the updating PC stage, does that cause any problems?
So the question is, how does having these initial phantom instructions be not affect the PC update? So, if you remember when we decided on our stages, and I guess this will work for explaining that, we combined fetch and PC update into the first stage. So it turns out that our PC update operation won't use that NOP information to compute the instruction length by accident. And that's part of the reason for doing that in the first fetch stage. So, other questions about this? Okay, so that's sort of the general procedure, and we'd like to figure out like what everything in the pipeline register is. So I'm going to give you a more systematic way of doing it, one that doesn't involve trying to draw pictures and hoping you didn't miss anything. And this is working from our book's description of what the instructions do. So one thing we're going to know is we always have a PC, and we always need the I-code. We have tons of control signals everywhere which are going to depend on the I-code. So that's going to be where we start. We always have an I-code, and we always have a PC. And then I can look at, well, what are the variables here that we use? We have RA, which we set in fetch and use in decode. And we also have RB, which we set and fetch using decode and write back. And what we're going to do is we're just going to say everything between when we set it and when we use it, we need that in a pipeline register. So since we use RB and fetch, since we set RB and fetch and use it in write back, every place in between that's a pipeline register needs RB in it. And since we use RA in decode, we need it between the fetch and decode pipeline register. And we just follow that procedure for all signals. We have val A here, set into code, used in execute, and val B, so that need to be in all the pipeline registers in between. That's just the decode to execute pipeline registers. We have val E, set in execute, used in write back, so it's going to be in the execute to memory and memory to write back pipeline registers, so it can get between the two. So just by doing this systematically, going through your book's description of what the instruction does, you can figure out what goes in my pipeline registers. So either you can do this for all the instructions at once and write out your whole pipeline register declaration, that is all you're going to need, or you can use this to just add one instruction at a time. So you have something written initially, and you just say, I want to add push. Let's see what push is going to need in pipeline registers and add it. add anything I'm missing. I would recommend the second approach, though if you want to just do everything all up front, that's okay too. It will work, obviously. I recommend the second approach mostly because otherwise you'll have lots of code that initially doesn't do anything. Okay. So one thing we're gonna do, and if you remember I talked about having that mux in the decode stage for choosing the destination registers. So one thing we're gonna do is we're gonna rename RB in this case to Desti. We're gonna compute the destination and we're gonna give that a different name. And this is strictly not necessary because, well, this information here that Desti and RB are different, well, we already have that beforehand because iCode plus RB tell us that what we're gonna write to. But computing the destination earlier is going to end up being helpful for things we'll talk about after we get back from the break, about dealing with some complications of implementing a pipeline processor. So we're going to follow this convention of computing register destinations in the decode step and passing the destination through the pipeline rather than the original register number. So one example of something this kind of makes easier is if we think about push. So push. Let's go through the same procedure. I neglected to write that we read RA here. But we read RA and RB from the instruction memory in fetch. And we use RA in decode. So RA needs to be in a pipeline register there. And we have val A and val B. And note that val A gets used in memory by the push instruction. So it needs to be passed from decode to execute and execute to memory. And we also have val E, which needs to be passed all the way through. Through from execute to write back. And if we follow the convention of setting dest E, this is one of the things that it might kind of make simpler. So here, our dest E is RSP, that's sort of hard-coded. That's technically redundant with the iCode. We know from the iCode being pushed that we're going to write to RSP, but it's going to end up being easier to just record that in the decode stage and read it later rather than recomputing it from the iCode. You can correctly implement the processor where you only figure it out in write back, but we'll have some very good reasons why we want to quickly figure out what registers does this instruction write. So any questions about figuring out pipeline registers and so on? Yeah.
So for push, you need to use the ALU to add 8.
So the question is, for push, you need to use the ALU to add 8. Okay. So our textbook does that. So it's subtract 8, yeah. Our textbook does that. as I mentioned when we talked about HCL, we don't care like whether you do it with something called Valley or not, as long as you produce the correct results.
So in the pipeline process, you have to at some stage the destiny will change.
At some stage, destiny will change. You mean the value of RSP or? Yes. So for the implementing the pipeline processor, when we have you do that for HCL, we're going to require that the instructions work correctly and they have the same timing as the implementation we describe. So as long as you do things at the same time, we don't care whether it's organized exactly like in the textbook. But we do care that you do it at the same time, like we want you to take the number of cycles this design takes, presumably because you're doing the same thing, roughly the same things. But like, if you're computing in a single link valley, or you make like a separate pipeline register for RSP plus 8, that's, we know, RSP minus 8, that's fine. So we actually now know everything about implementing a standard pipeline processor, except that it won't work. So let's look at a case here where we're going to have a problem. So here, I have add R8, R9, add R9, R8, and I'm saying R8 and R9 are initially 800 and 900. So what this should do is we add R8 and R9. This implies R9 now equals 1700. And then we add R9 and R8, so 1700 plus 800, that should imply R8 ends up equaling 2500. But that's not what's going to happen in the pipeline processor I showed you earlier. Instead, we're going to, during cycle one, we're going to read 800 and 900, and that's what's going to end up happening for instruction one. So that looks fine. And then during the next cycle, while we're adding 800 and 900, we're going to read 900 and 800. We're not going to read 1700 because that's not going to be written until cycle three. So the register file doesn't have the value yet. It's still being, it's being computed in the add and sent to here at the same time we're reading the old value from there. So we have this 900 we end up reading, which is meant to be 1700 based on what the instruction is supposed to do. So this is called a data hazard. A hazard is a case where our straightforward pipeline processor does the wrong thing based on what our instruction set is supposed to do. And another way of looking at this is that our pipeline implementation, the way it implements these instructions is first we read R8 and R9. Then we read R9 and R8, then we write R9 for the first instruction, then we write R8 for the second instruction. But what we're supposed to do, what the Y86 specification would say we do, is we read R8 and R9, we write R9 for all four instruction one, then we read R9 and R8 for instruction two, and write R8. So our pipeline implementation is doing things in a different order, and this is being done in a different order such that we get a different result. Like, if we didn't get a different result, we wouldn't care. But we get a different result because we're doing things in a different order than the specification. So any questions about what's going on here before we talk about how we're going to fix this? So this is obviously is a problem, and it's one we definitely have to solve. We don't want, you know, you expect this assembly to work, you know, to compute this 2500 value, not 1700. So there's several different solutions, and we're going to talk about two of them today and some more of them when we get back from the break. So the simplest solution is to make it someone else's problem. We can change our instruction set architecture. We can redefine what the instruction does. So right now, our specification for the add instruction says it reads the two registers, computes the sum, and writes the result. And then we go on, then goes on to the next instruction. That's what the specification says. That's what we read when we find out what does this instruction do. We could rewrite that to say the add instruction, it reads the two registers, computes the sum of the results, and two instructions later in the program writes the result. We could write that as our what the add instruction does. Or three instructions later, sorry. And in this case, you know, that would be that's a valid choice, and then the compiler needs to do something like this when you write the code that previously corresponded to those adds. Or if you're writing assembly by hand, you need to do that. So you either insert some extra knobs, so you do nothing in between, or you like find other work to do ideally. So usually this is not acceptable. Like usually you're not happy with having these weird restrictions, like our add instruction doesn't quite work the way you think. But real processors have chosen this design. Usually, and to varying degrees, but real processors have chosen this solution. It's a real solution that some processors have chosen, and it has obviously the advantage of making the hardware much easier to make. You can think of it as sort of an extreme version of RISC sort of thing. Like we're making the hardware design really easy. but giving the compiler and assembly writers a lot more work. But usually we don't like this. We don't like telling our hardware designers, hey, you have to do all this work. It's also pretty annoying from a perspective of upgrading our hardware, because what if I want to use a deeper pipeline? Then I have to change the number of knobs. And that's usually also not acceptable, but this is a real approach that some ISAs have taken, where they will do things that are effectively allowing the hardware to, you know, have things happen later to permit this sort of implementation. Now, let's talk about a more acceptable solution. And that's going to follow the same principle. So we know that if we're writing the assembly, we could solve the problem by just adding a couple knobs to delay the instruction until the value is ready. And so our simplest and most generic solution to this problem is the hardware does that. The hardware has some logic which figures out, oh, there's going to be a problem if I try to do this. I'm not going to get a different result than the user wants. So I'm just going to start executing knobs. And, you know, I'm going to keep track of where I am in the program, but I'm going to execute a couple knobs until we're ready, and then I'm going to keep going. So conceptually, the hardware just inserts these knobs. And we're going to call this stalling. So we have two pieces of extra logic. So sometimes we want to keep the PC unchanged. So we're going to have some condition where sometimes we increment our PC and sometimes we leave it the same because there's a hazard going on and we can't go to the instruction. And sometimes we're going to put do nothing values in the pipeline register. So rather than saying, hey, I read registers 8 and 9, and telling the code, here, execute registers 8 and 9, we can tell the code, hey, I read register none and register none, why don't you do that? And basically give a knob that doesn't exist in memory to the pipeline. Yes?
So essentially we lost a lot of the advantage that we wanted from pipeline.
So the question is basically, doesn't this mean, yeah, that we've lost a lot of the advantage of pipelining? Yes. So it's not all the advantage, because we don't always have hazards. We'll only do this in a case where there is a data hazard, where there's a hazard. We won't do this in the case where, like some of the examples I showed before, where if we don't do anything, we get the right values all the time, everything works out.
So this is a hazard for any instruction that has to write back stage?
So this hazard exists for, because we read the registers in a different cycle of the instruction than we write it, yes. So anytime we read and write registers, we have this problem. But it doesn't exist, like, for example, it exists in this case because they use the same registers. If they use different registers, we don't need to stall.
Oh, I see.
And hopefully that sort of thing is a common case. And when we get back from break, we will talk about some solutions which are faster than stalling, but don't handle all the cases. So we're talking about stalling first because it always solves the problem. We're going to have some solutions which are faster but don't always solve the problem. So what stalling looks like is we execute our first instruction, and then we start looking at our second instruction, and we decide, oh, wait a moment, I can't keep do that. You know, there's a conflict with something that we're already trying to do, and we just say, here's a knob. So instead of sending 9 and 8, which are the values we read from the instruction memory, we override those values with some logic I'm not showing on this picture with register none. And that gets passed through the pipeline, and we try to write to register none a couple cycles later. That's harmless. That's a knob. And we keep doing that until we determine that we don't have any conflicts with any active instructions. And once we do that, we not only send the real values from the instruction memory through the pipeline, but we also start advancing the PC again. Beforehand, we also had the logic where we were adding nothing to the PC instead of adding two. So these are our two cycles of stalling. Yes?
Processor work, like a single cycle processor for that instruction?
So the question, is this equivalent to making the processor work like a single cycle processor for that instruction? So no, because during cycle 3, we are actually doing two instructions. We are fetching the second instruction while we're doing the write back for the first. So we still have parallelism we didn't have. We just have less of it than our pipeline is supposed to give us. So another way of looking at this, this is like the view from what are the pipeline register outputs, so what's the input in each cycle to the stages. Another way we can look at it is we can say what instructions are active in each stage. So here I'm doing the same sort of information, but instead of writing what values are in the pipeline registers, I'm saying what instruction are we fetching, what instruction are we decoding, and so on. And you can see I've labeled the stalls we've inserted as nop or bubble. So we'll call when we insert something in the pipeline, that's a pseudo no-op instruction. That's from stalling, we'll call that a pipeline bubble. That's the name we're going to use for these inserted nops. So you can see here we let the add stay in fetch because we decided it wasn't ready to go. And we kept it in fetch until we were able to send it normally down the pipeline. And while we were keeping it in fetch, we just sent bubbles down the pipeline because we had to put something there. Like, we can't leave any of these boxes blank. Okay. So there's another way you can implement it, which looks different as far as the pipeline register values and as far as what's in what stage, but achieves the same effect. So I was showing stalling by we stop the instruction when we're fetching it. Maybe it's more convenient to figure out there's a hazard later on. Like sometimes we can't figure it out right away when we fetch, so, or it might be just inconvenient to do that. So we can let the add go to the decode stage and then just keep it in the decode stage until it's ready to go on. And if we're doing that, in order to execute the rest of the program properly, we'll keep the instruction before it in the fetch stage. Instruction after it, sorry, in the fetch stage. And this achieves the same effect, but it has slightly different values for the pipeline registers, and obviously we have some extra logic to make the stalling happen for two sets of registers and not one. But often in real processors, you won't figure out, oh, I need to stall this instruction until you start computing some information for it. So that would look like this. So here we're stalling after we've computed the register numbers and fetched to decode, but sometime during decode rather than actually read the values from the, rather use the values created from the register file, we send these not values down the pipeline, including register num, to make those pipeline bubbles happen again. And we still have a bunch of stalling. These two inserted nops, they just get inserted a little later in the pipeline, it's the same effect. Any questions about this alternative? Okay, so talked about our mechanism for dealing with these hazards. So now that we understand what that looks like, let's go through a little exercise here, which is I have my same processor, fetch, decode, execute, write back, add processor, only adds. How many cycles of stalling do I need to execute this correctly? So this has hazards. How much stalling do I need? And my recommendation for figuring this out is to make something kind of like this. Like figure out what's in each cycle when, so you can know, so you can figure out how much stalling is needed. And remember that we need to wait till the end of write back to write the value that we read during the middle of the decode stage. Okay. So I'll give you a few minutes to think about that. I recommend checking with your neighbor to see if you agree. And I strongly recommend writing things down because I would probably get the wrong answer if I didn't. right, who needs more time? No one apparently. Who has an answer they are willing to explain? Okay. There. Yeah, back there.
Behind you. How about
one? One, okay. So how did you come up with that?
So the add queue instruction writes back two instructions later, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we need to have two instructions between each add queue that's dependent on another add queue.
Okay.
So if we put the dump installed in the exact middle.
Yep. Yes. So that's the right idea. So I'll go through my explanation of this. So I'm going to show you diagrams of instruction timing where I write time going horizontally. So here I have cycle 0, 1, 2, 3, 4 going horizontally. And I'm going to write below that, I have instruction 1. I'm saying during cycle 0, it's in fetch. During cycle 1, it's in decode. During cycle 2, it's in execute, and so on. And at the same time, instruction 2 is in fetch during cycle 1, while instruction 1 is in decode. It's in decode during cycle 2, while instruction 1 is in execute, and so on. So that's a notation I'll be using a lot. So any questions about what that means? So time going across with the instructions below it. So here's my picture of the situation we have there. And I've written, so what we want to do is we fetch the first instruction, and the cycle later we fetch the next one. So that's what we want to normally do. And when we have a dependency, we need to be able to, like here, so here are two dependencies. Cases where we read a value that was written. So I need it to be the case that I've written R9 by the time I read it later. And I write R9 at the end of the write-back stage, and I read it during the middle of the decode stage. During the end of the write-back, because our register file, we set up its inputs, and then during the end of the cycle, at that rising edge, it uses them. And during the middle, because sometime in the middle of the decode stage, I send values, and I get the values back before the end of the cycle. And I've drawn these arrows here indicating the direction of the data transfer that should happen, starting from where we write the value and going to where we read it. And if those arrows go backwards, we have a problem. And in order to make both of these arrows go forwards, I needed to insert one hole, this red X here, and that's our stall. And this is a way of showing we needed exactly one stall. And note that, as pointed out, we just needed a certain spacing between the reads and writes. And we could get that, in this case, with one stall, even though there are two different dependencies. And this is a reason why I strongly recommend writing out something like this to figure this out, because if you just like count the pairs and do it, you'll often miss something like that. So any questions on how I figure this out? Our solution is? So that's solving our hazards with stall. So someone asked earlier, well, doesn't this get rid of the whole point of doing pipelining? So let's think about, like, how do we compute how bad the effect is? And this is going to depend on the programs we have, because whether we have a hazard or not depends on what registers we're using. Like, our compiler might be able to do something to make them better or worse. But let's say I took the program I care about and I measured it very carefully, and I found out that 1% of the instructions stall for exactly 4 cycles, 2% stall for 3, 10% stall for 2, and 15% stall for 1 on the processor design I've chosen. So one quantity we like to compute to measure the performance of a pipeline processor is the number of cycles per instruction. So the average number of cycles each instruction takes. So what is that going to be based on these measurements? You can check your answer with your neighbor. Someone wants to tell me, how should I compute this? Yeah.
The average would be 1 plus the average amount of skulls per instruction.
Okay. So, yeah, we're going to start by saying that by default, we have 1 cycle between instructions. The convention I'm going to use is when I say an instruction stalls for exactly 1 cycle, we're saying that that instruction takes extra time, and we're not including that extra time in time that future instructions are delayed. We're just counting stalls as belonging to 1 instruction. So that means that 15% of the time, instead of we take an extra cycle to execute an instruction, 10% of the time we take 2, and I just add that in. 2% of the time we take 3, and 1% of the time we take 4. We add this all together, we get 1.45. Another way you could have computed this is you could say 15% of the time we take 2 cycles between instructions because we've stalled once and we should take 1 to start out with. And 10% we would take 3 and so on. And whenever none of the stalling happens, so whenever 100% minus 15 minus 10 minus 0 to 01. So in the cases where we did install all the other instructions, you would take 1 and you'd get the same answer. So both are valid ways of thinking about this. So this is compute this cycles per instruction, but we know that if we're comparing our single cycle and our pipeline processor, this isn't the only thing which matters because the whole point of pipelining is that the time of each cycle is shorter. So yes, of course we have more cycles, but they should be much, much shorter cycles. So to actually know what the overall effect is, we need to know about how the cycle time changed. So let's say that we did our critical path analysis and originally we had 1200 picoseconds. And when we had our 5-stage processor, we got that down to 300 picoseconds. So we had some of that diminishing returns I talked about, so because we have a fourth the time for a 5-stage processor. But we have better throughput. So how much better is our throughput going to be? How can we compute that? Yeah.
I guess cycles per instruction times new cycle time divided by old cycle time.
Yeah. So previously we were averaging also 1200 picoseconds an instruction, and now we're taking 1.45 times 300, just computing picoseconds per instruction, and those are the numbers you want to compare. That's sort of what actually matters for that's what our throughput represents, is how fast does the average instruction take as far as like time between completions. And if we compute that, we get that it's about 2.76 times faster. So we have what would probably be a 5-stage processor, which is like a little less than 3 times faster. And this sort of, less than ideal returns is very typical. So we lost some of our performance because we didn't divide up our stages evenly, and we lost some of our performance because of these hazards. So any questions about this calculation? General. Okay, so we talked about data hazards, and that was cases where we were reading a value that hadn't really been written yet. And our solution to that was stalling. And we're going to have another type of hazards for which we're going to have to stall. That's a more tricky type, and that's control hazards. So with control hazards, the problem is we don't even know what instruction to run. So here, in order to know whether that jump equal should go to the add or whatever is at address FFFF, we need to know what's the result of the add, because it's going to set the condition codes and we need to know what ZF is. And we don't want to read the ZF that happened to be set before that add, because that's not related to what the jump is supposed to do. went on afterwards. Yeah. So we don't actually know what value to have for the PC. So the simplest solution to this is to stall. That conceptually, you know, we could have just inserted two knobs here. To wait for the condition codes to be set. And so we'll do that by stalling. So here we're gonna have the PC set to the address of the jump, and we're just gonna keep that the same is one thing we could do while we're waiting for the jump to finish. And then when we actually know the value of the condition codes, when we finally figure out that ZF is zero, so we don't jump, then we finally go on to the next instruction. But before that, we have to keep things where they are, because otherwise, well, we could execute the add, but maybe that's not what we want to do. We don't want to write a value to R11 if that's not what we're supposed to do next based on the conditional jump. So in this picture, this way I've implemented things, it looks like we do the jumps logic all in our fetch stage. The way we're going to usually think about it is we're going to say that we do the condition code calculations in the execute stage. This is a choice that our textbook design makes, and it has some nice features. The biggest thing is that it's easy to figure out whether we're reading the right version of the condition codes. That we want to read the condition codes right after they're set. We don't want to read a version from a prior or a future instruction, because it's different in place in the pipeline. So the way we will visualize this is we'll say that we execute our instruction here, then we have a conditional jump, and we let it go down the pipeline into execute, and here we compute the results. And we just let it keep going through the pipeline. It's not going to do anything other than compute that result. And because it's in the execute stage, it's going to get the value of ZF that was set just previously by the previous instructions execute stage, which is exactly the condition code value you want. So we're going to have the most recent value of the condition codes, but not something that's from like whatever's after the jump, if that were possible. And based on the result, we're going to have to communicate between two different instructions. So we're going to use the result of the jump to decide what to fetch next. So our fetch stage, while the jump has not gotten to execute, it hasn't read the condition codes yet because they're not available, it's going to be waiting, and when it finally has something to read, then we're going to fetch that new instruction. That makes sense. So we're waiting to find out whether the condition code, whether the conditions are met or not. And while we don't know whether conditions are met, because, well, yes, there's a value of that like signal and execute, but it's not the right one. So while we're waiting for it to be the right one, we're going to just stall. We're not going to execute any instructions, and we're going to send a pipeline bubble to decode. When we finally know we've waited long enough that we're evaluating the condition codes correctly, which we can track by looking at where did the jump now, then we'll actually execute the real next instruction, because we'll look at that signal and say, what PC do I want to use? Do I want to use the PC that's from ValP, from PC plus something, or do I want to use the PC that's from the ValC part of the jump instruction? The address in the jump instruction. Any questions about this? So this is one case where we can solve by stalling. We'll have a different solution, which we'll talk about probably after the break, which will be a bit better than that, but you can just solve this by stalling. Stalling solves all our problems. And there's another control hazard we have to worry about, which is return. And we're going to do the same thing. But in return, so in conditional jump, we found out what to do in the execute stage, because that's where we could read condition codes. In return, we find out what to do in the memory stage, because that's where we read the address from the stack that we want to return to. So until then, we're going to do the same thing. We're going to have in our fetch stage, return goes down the pipeline, it computes the address to read memory, then we read memory. And while we're waiting, we're going to say, do we have the value from memory yet? No, we haven't waited long enough. Do we have it yet? No, we haven't waited long enough. And keep waiting until it's finally ready, and then we're going to have it be sent to us from here to fetch the next angle. And we can't shortcut this. You might say, well, we usually don't use the memory. Why don't we read the memory earlier? And we can't do that in general because maybe we wrote the address on the stack of the instruction before. So either we would need to detect and show that that isn't happening, or we just wait until we get to the memory stage. In our design, we're always going to wait until the memory stage. We're not going to try to take any shortcuts, because that always works. You don't have to worry about the value not having been written to memory yet. So in both for both these hazards, the pattern is we're stalling. The form of the stalling is we have our fetch for the next instruction, which just can't know what to do, so it just waits for its signals, and we send a knock down the pipeline instead of the actual next instruction we don't know about. And that's how we can deal with both of these what we call control hazards, where we don't know what instruction to run. And in both cases, the way we're visualizing it is that we run the control flow instruction normally, quote unquote, and we read its values in the fetch stage for the next instruction to figure out what to do. Now, this is a case where we're writing values for an instruction that are used in a different pipeline stage, and that's okay because, well, the conditional jump better tell the next instruction what to do. So any questions about this? Okay, so to finish up, let's talk about where things are in our pipeline now that we've done things. And, you know, clarify our explanation of why we do things where we do. So we have our fetch, where we do our instruction memory operations and most PC computation. So we saw that with return and conditional jump, that PC computation is going to be somewhat delayed. We're going to do it later in the pipeline, and we're going to send that value back when we're to the fetch stage that actually needs it later on, because it's not available yet. But the common case is done in fetch. We also decided that we're going to read our condition codes in execute and write them in execute. So writing them in execute is obvious because that's where we do our computations that set them. Reading them in execute, this avoids worrying about do we have the most recent version. If we just always read in execute, we know things go to the execute stage in the order they appear in the program. We don't have to worry about having the wrong thing. And the same principle applies to our memory read and write. Because we know we read the data memory in the order the program executes, we don't need to worry about whether we have a data hazard with values that we write to memory and read, because we always write and read in the memory stage, and instructions get to the memory stage in order. And this is one of the reasons to have one memory stage, so that it avoids trying to figure out, is there a data hazard between this push and pop? There isn't. Isn't as far as the values in the data memory are concerned, because the push, if it's before the pop in the program, will read from memory before pop writes. And we also have a detail we haven't talked about, but that is definitely important, which is writing the stat register. And we're going to do that in our write-back stage. And the reason for this is it's not because we don't know how to write the stat register earlier. We can figure out what the stat register should be in the fetch stage very easily. But we don't want to halt until we're actually done. We don't want to set an invalid instruction until we're actually done. Because if we halted, if we wrote it in the fetch stage, then you write to memory and then halt, and you look at your contents of memory, well, you didn't write the value yet because you halted before that write to memory instruction got to its memory stage. So it's important that we do all our stat updates later on in the pipeline, so all the other instructions appear to have completed first. So that's what I have for today. Any questions on this before in our last minute? Okay, so next time we will talk about better ways of solving hazards. So we'll have a strategy for solving some control hazards, but not all of them. That will be faster. And we'll have a way of solving some data hazards, but not all of them. That will be faster. Stalling, which we've taught you, solves all the hazards. It's just not always the fastest thing to do. And that's why we taught it first.